No choice.
I could promise I'll quit and make it out of here, no.
And, break the stride, if I get. This is a study that we've undertaken to look at in detail, boundary structure and extreme winds. My collaborator, Andy Penny, works with Pat Harrop, Naval Postgraduate School, and he's been doing an incredible job crunching an awful lot of data. So the objectives on this is to look at the pairs of high wall drop zones. One of the strategies we employed in all of these storms was to have the 53rd deploy two zones as fast as they could, not just one. And we did that in Germany in 2008. We did it in Edgy in 2010. So with that, plus the AXBT data, we were able to profile down through the boundary layer in the atmosphere and the next layer in the ocean simultaneously, and use those observations plus the SFMR surface winds to do at least a ballpark bulk aerodynamic estimate. Fluxes, we haven't quite gotten that far in the study yet, but there are some very fascinating differences in the fine scale detail of the boundary profiles. So as I say, most of these profiles that I'll show you are taken within about a minute. Some were even 15 seconds apart. They could have been 15 hours apart, probably, you can tell by looking at the similarity of the profiles. And the big help in being able to interpret these profiles was because of the airborne radar video that we recorded in place to at least be able to map out what the convective structure looked like. And actually, one of the windfalls was being able to utilize the synthetic aperture radar data from numerous satellites that Hans so ably undertook to have happened. We had one of the SIR passes over Midji at about the same time as some of these deployments. And then again, the joint flights with the Astra. A number of firsts in this undertaking, as you can see here. It was the first year. The reason we're able to do a study like this now is because it's the first year that the GPS system on the sun was good enough to provide data all the way to the surface. Ever since 1997, when the GPS drop zone system came into being, we lose 80% of the data in winds above about 40, 50 meters per second. They'd stop, they'd lose lock and stop transmitting at about 150, 200 meters. That's why in the Tucson message you have these things like Jan referred to as the MBL wind or WL150 wind is an effort to get a mean that you can then relate to the 10 meter wind, because the 10 meter wind was never measured. Well, we're now able to measure it. In fact, a lot of these, I can believe the heights that were estimated by EOL, which I guess I can mention. We had measurements down at 3 meters above something. 15 meter waves, I'm not sure what that means exactly, but nevertheless, gave a good observations of the wind structure for the first time. It's hardly 94 units that are manufactured by this company called Ubilox. And this resulted in the, I believe it's the second highest surface wind measurement ever made, including all other sources, about 90 meters per second in measurement. It was absolutely the highest SFMR wind I've ever seen, 86 meters per second. And furthermore, we were able to, for the first time at the Shoeys prodding, we were able to make a series of diagonal flight patterns just outside the eye wall, which NOAA never said they would never do in a million years, but the Air Force guy just said, sure, no problem. And that worked out quite well. So this is a comparison of the two storms. In Edgy, we came close to a record low surface pressure of 880, actually the aircraft measured 890. It went down a few more millibars, according to satellite estimates, the next day. I think 876 is the record. And that corresponded to those 85 to 90 meter per second winds, just when we had the final flight. And the same with Midji, we were able to capture the rapid deepening phase of that storm down to 905 or 902 millibars, and peak winds of about 75 or so meters per second. The Pacific map profiles that we observed, and this was plotted up by Pat Harrod real time, show the, this particular profile shows that record heights of Maryland just inside of the flight level with max, not too much different from the flight level and surface winds. Now, these were two resources that we had for interpreting these profiles. The one on the left is Hans's SAR image from Edging on the 17th on 925. And Hans, I was never able to get a hold of you to get that real data from you, so I just scanned this off your calendar, which was just great. Thanks for the calendar. Make some scientific use of that. Anyway, it was within about an hour or so, but one of the first outwall penetration that, that provided this radar image on the right. What caught my attention were a series of boundary layer profiles. We were plotting potential temperature, radial wind component, total wind speed as a function of log height in order to emphasize what's going on the boundary layer. That image on the left, you can look at the potential temperature and see that as the sun gets down around 100 meters or below, there's an increase in theta. That's not supposed to be possible if you consider it to be a vertical profile of these super adiabatic flash rate that shouldn't last. But these were repeatable. These observations showed up in six or eight different profiles. So I kept wondering what was really going on. I also happened to correspond to a layer of the constant inflow and the strongest inflow right at the surface below about 100, 150 meters. That's where all the action is, and we've never been able to observe that before. And typical wind speed plots on the right. Two sons drop within 30 seconds of each other, but one gives us, they both give wind max up around 100 meters or so, up close to 110 meters per second. However, one produced a surface wind estimate of 90 meters per second, the other surface wind estimate of 7. What's going on there? So this is what we're trying to diagnose. This is a estimate for boundary layer depth, mixed layer depth, as revealed by the constant potential temperature profiles. So let's just another look at these weird potential temperature profiles that we then began to take a look at. So one of the first things I did was to plot up the actual air temperature as a function of log height for these eyewall songs and compare it with the XPT observations. And not all our XPTs worked, and the SONs worked, but nevertheless, it gives us a pretty good idea of where the fluxes are taking place. Something dramatic is happening in the lowest 5 meters of the atmosphere and the upper few meters of the ocean. Now,
can you go back to that slide just for a second?
Sure.
Can you read the numbers?
Right. That's on the left for the air temperature, or both. It's 20 degrees to 28 degrees. Skip the next green light. So one of the first things that we decided to do was compare the raw profiles with various estimates of various attempts to do some smoothing on the profiles, because there's a lot of despiking and noisy data that needs to be taken care of, and this is what EOL folks are expert at. We tried our own version of smoothing on the left there, which was a little heavier smoothing than the EOL used, but there were some major differences comparing with the actual raw data as a function of pressure here that, you know, it didn't look like some kind of a nice regular smoother was being followed. And the techniques both of us tried with the Aspen software just went crazy when it encountered an area here where the solid actually started rising in an updraft and produced this weird profile in an updraft. same time, the flow rate actually is above zero, it's gone up, and then falls off again. Trying to replicate what's going on there, either with the ERL averaging scheme or with equipment that I use, just not very satisfactory. So, well, anything I'm going to say from here on out, you have to take it with a grain of salt, because we're not sure we've got the profiles, especially the boundary layer, correct. This is the wind speed that resulted from these two procedures, and again, you can see that EOL passed the data, smooths over this area where the sun goes up, right here. And there's quite a discrepancy here between the raw data and the average data in terms of the shape of the profile. So, probably got some work to do. So, first thing I did was took the profiles from these diagonal flight legs that had never been done before. This was a radar image of the eye, just outside the eye, and ran a series of flight tracks. First, downwind, which I think the airplane was flying like 400 knots, and then upwind, and it was 550 ground speed. So it took like an hour and a half to do this leg upwind and about 15 minutes to go downwind. So I had them drop the sawns on the upwind legs, and we were able to complete two of these downwind upwind legs. So I've got several places where there's about an hour separation, 45 minutes between these pairs of sawns that they launched pretty much storm relative and identically the same place. And for the first approximation, they're not too much different. What I've done here is I just sampled two profiles, these two up here and these two down here, and plotted up the radial and wind and the total wind speed. It's the radial wind over here, total wind here. You can see those colors, okay? Profiles don't look too different. Big wind up here, and then this layer of constant wind down below. Main thing these profiles showed, and same thing with that other pair here, and then I've done the central temperature on this, this curve here, and vertical motion on this. And one of the really unusual features of this these profiles is the fact that you have this layer of constant wind with height. What's going on there? If you had a typical well-mixed boundary layer, you should have a log well all the way to the surface. Log laws don't exist in high wind hurricanes, we're finding out. So we've got to go back to the drawing board. It's not a specified process. That's my opinion. I'll step sticking to it. in the eyewall on the 17th, I think we have two more profiles here. And these same two locations relative to the eyewall on the edge on the 17th. So we've come up with some really strange looking profiles, especially this one right here where the sun goes up. And then that's falling again, theta has gone up by 2 degrees. And long story short, turns out that you're confusing horizontal gradients with vertical gradients. At this point here, the sun actually pops into the eye and produces a dramatically different wind speed trace here that I just mentioned before. There's a strong shear on one of the profiles, having no shear on the other. And that picture is repeated time and again with these various sons, and I don't have that much time to go into this, but just suffice it to say that we had the same thing with Meji on the 16th, where the wind on the right side of used things here. One of the things that the radar data showed up were these scallop-type features around the edge of the eye, and I'm interpreting those, as you'll see in a minute, from as micro-scale micropulses. It's contributing to the mixing between the eye and the eye wall. This one indicates that we did the same thing with Jiangmi with roughly 70 meters per second winds. Using the radar, again we see the scallops shaped structure on the inner edge of the eye wall, and again dramatically different profiles of everything. Temperature, vertical motion, and just very radically different. I was going to explain a little bit about the features that we saw in the SAR relative to the radar. Within an hour of each other, but I don't have time for that. Just want to show this one lotus image. This is a 22 high-resolution image just a few hours before sunset, before those measurements were obtained. One of the things you see is endemic to many intense storms are these spiral-shaped patterns originating down the surface and spiraling up the eyewall and out in the outflow. There are several of these here. I believe those are reflections of these microvortices we see on the radar image. Furthermore, I think it's what explains these dramatically different profiles, depending on what side of one of these microvortices or microvortices the saw falls on. Either the outside or the inside, so it can direct the saw directly more into the eyewall, or it can suck it right into the eye. And this is nothing new. This is a photo that was taken by U2, September 28, 1958. It shows these in spades. In fact, it shows the what I call these microvortices wrapping around into a mesovortex that Mike Montgomery talks about in terms of vortex Rossby waves. So this is quite an image that shows both of these scales. And I've just kind of sketched on here the shape of the spiral shape of the features. And similarly, with the space shuttle astronauts, one of the jobs I had for a while was teaching them how to take handheld stereo photos. And this is a particularly interesting one I did in the Eastern Pacific Caribbean Museum that I think showed these kind of spiral shaped features. So you might say, well, so what? You get dramatically different profiles, which I'm hypothesizing due to these features that have existed, that we've known have existed for years, but have not known how to interpret, and so on and so forth. But the impact for interpreting the impact of, I believe, is the fact that these this eyewall wind pattern, we call it U-shaped profiles, where the stress curl is a peak just inside the radius of maximum wind, not in the center of the storm. And furthermore, this so-called string of pearls that I hypothesize may very well underestimate the magnitude of the stress curl. It's like a tornado. The micro vortices that rotate around in a tornado have the same thing on two different scales, actually, in a hurricane. And the fact that you've got all these little micro vortices that we have not ever been able to sample will give you a higher wind stress curl than you would get from just the mean profile. I'm not sure what impact that has on the forcing, specifying the forcing. I was asking Eric what's the difference between a Rankine vortex type forcing where you have the main wind stress curl located at the center, or this kind of profile where you've got it in the shape. For storm-like Malakas, it can make a big difference where the radius of maximum wind is 110 kilometers. You've got this donut-shaped forcing over a large area rather than a point from the center. So again, I just conclude by the longer list of observations that we're trying to put together and synthesize for these interpreting these highly variable modular features in these storms.
I'd like to also probably expand this by looking at some of the drop zone data that was taken by the project in the Atlantic this year. And there are one or two storms that released the category 4. So, well, let's see. Thanks for your attention.
One question? No? Okay.